Though Jane Ann Phillips' novel, Quiet Dell, centers around real-life murders in her home state of West Virginia, it's really a hopeful book.
The terrible thing about a victim is that that victim be forgotten. The thing that the book is trying to do is to make them real, to bring them back in a kind of way, save the children in the only way they can be saved, which is in literature.
Hear how Jane Ann Phillips researched the story about a lonely widow with three children in the Great Depression who turned to a matrimonial service and was snared by a predator. Fact and fiction are woven together to create this darkly poetic and suspenseful novel. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air, and we're off to the Kansas City Public Library, where the author talked with fellow novelist Whitney Terrell for the Fall 2014 Writers at Work series. But first, we'll hear Jane Ann Phillips read from her novel, Quiet Dell.
Well, thank you so much for coming. I'm going to read from several voices in Quiet Dell without any spoilers. So if you haven't read the book yet, I'm not going to tell you anything that you will discover in its pages. I'm going to just introduce you to the characters and the story. And of course, Whitney and I will be talking after the reading, filling in a little bit more. Don't read the acknowledgments page until you get to the end of the book. Asta Eicher lived in Park Ridge, Illinois. I'm actually on my way there after my reading tonight. The Eichers' graves have been unmarked for almost 85 years. And when I was writing this book, I said to myself, if I finish this book, I'm going to make sure there are markers on those graves. So this is a very real story. I'm going to start with Annabelle. Christmas Eve, 1930, Park Ridge, Illinois, just outside Chicago. Annabelle is 9 years old. Oh, and I should also mention, when Harry Powers, alias Cornelius Pearson, is tried in Clarksburg, West Virginia, which is a town very near the little hamlet of Quiet Dell, the courthouse is being renovated, and the trial is held in the local opera house. So the trial takes place on stage, in front of a glittering, tall backdrop of painted forest trees left over from a prior production. So remember that as we're hearing from Annabelle here, because she's a rather special child. Annabelle begins. When the year turns, there are bells on the wind. All the old years fall on the ground in lights. When you walk across those lights, it sounds like walking on all the piled up leaves of giant trees. But up high, the bells are ringing for everyone alive. There are silver and gold and glass bells you can see through, and sleigh bells 100 years old. My grandmother said there was a whisper for each one dead that year, and a feather drifting for each one waiting to be born. My mother says that's just a story, but I always do hear the bells, even in my sleep. And everything in front of me is all white and open like a field. Then I start dreaming. The trees in my dreams sparkle. It's quiet in the dark, and I'm indoors on a stage. The trees are behind me, but they're alive, touching limbs and stirred just so. A silent spirit seems to move among them. The light has found me. It's a large theater, rows and rows, and a balcony I glimpse through the gleam. The audience is quiet, waiting for me to speak. Perhaps they're watching a play, my play, or a play in which I perform. I can't make out faces beyond the footlights, but I see the tilt of heads and the shapes of ladies' hats, and a glow seems to float amongst them. There's a hum of admiration or excitement, and a swell of whisper like applause. Then the lights on the stage darken. I hear people weeping. So moved are they by the production. Grandmother used to say I might find myself upon a stage one day as an actor or the author of a play. Duty is our Boston Terrier that follows Hart everywhere and sleeps on our beds by turns, and Duty is in my dream. I stand on the stage before the trees, and Duty is there, sitting just at the edge of the light. His little legs are stubby, and his chest is broad, and his short brown coat shines like a mirror. Duty's eyes are wide apart, and he can seem to gaze in two directions. But he only looks off toward the wings to where no one can see. Grandmother always told me that our dreams are wishes or fancies, gifts of the dream fairies that guide and care for us in our sleep. She said that poems and stories are the whisperings of angels we cannot see, beings once like you and me, who know more than we can know while we are here. Address me in your mind when I am gone, grandmother told me. I will hear you always and will send a reply in the sounds of the grass and the wind and other little signs, for we no longer speak in words when we have slipped away. She talked about the silken cord that binds her soul to mine. She slept and woke and slept and woke. The cord is a real cord, and I keep it under my pillow. Not all of it. Once it was very long, the last of the silk braid Mother used on the sofa pillows. Grandmother made a game of it for walking through the park. We children went afternoons with Grandmother, single file, holding to the cord. She used to say there was one of her and three of us. We children must hold to the cord, just so. She fashioned one large knot for each right hand, and I was first behind her. We held to the cord in silence, for Grandmother liked us to hear small sounds. The cricket and the mantis, grasses moving in the meadow. Sound travels even in the cord we hold, Grandmother said, for the heart beats in the hand. You are not like others, Grandmother liked to tell me. Your dreams see past us.
You're listening to Jane Ann Phillips on New Letters on the Air, reading from her novel, Quiet Dell.
Cornelius Pearson, as he calls himself to Astor Eicher in their correspondence through the American Friendship Society, a matrimonial agency during the 1930s, has been to Park Ridge and has taken Asta away on a pre-wedding trip. And he returns a week later for the children who think they are going to meet their mother. This is from their trip as they come to Quiet Dell. This first paragraph or two I'm reading is one of the few sections from Harry Powers' point of view, called Windy Nights. Later, near evening, the rain is drenching. He can barely see the turn onto the narrow dirt road. The children are asleep, lulled by the pounding rain. He slows the coupe, not to startle them, easing the car onto mud, for Quiet Dell Road is standing water, and the creek along one side is nearly to its banks. The garage is near. He steers to the left side of the road and imagines the car afloat, riding the stream to Clarksburg. But he sees the garage, a simple hulk with a flat slant roof, intricate enough below ground. He will assure their sleep with the chloroform and rag in the glove box, open the garage door, and back the car inside. His blood is singing. He's entered that outer region in which it all begins. A penumbra around his head pulses like the charged gray emanation of a sunspot. He peers into a cloudiness in which flashes of brilliant red appear. Dutch royal purple, his father used to say. A beating well deserved, the color of his backside, if not his face, each time. For only a Nesbitt-Schmutzer, a diseased cur, sh**s in its own cage, betrays its own. He feels a surge and grips the wheel, but the coupe slides to the right and halts, subtly tilted, the back right wheel in mud to the axle. The arcs of the headlights appear to fly into the downpour at a rakish angle. He leaves the engine engaged, an essential vibration, and applies the brake. The boy first, and when he's senseless, the girls, while he gets the boy inside, down the ladder to the cell. He takes the bottle of liquid from the glove box, grips the rag, inhales deeply, not to be affected in the close interior of the car. He holds his breath then and begins. Emily Thornhill is a 35-year-old, happily unmarried reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And she's called into the case by a banker in Park Ridge, a sort of a town father, William Malone, because he wants someone from the Tribune who will handle the story in a way that respects the family. And so Emily Thornhill has gotten into an automobile and driven all night to arrive in Quiet Dell, West Virginia. Emily has with her the Eicher family pet, Duty, D-U-T-Y, the Boston Terrier referred to earlier in the story. And, you know, this case was one of the first wildly publicized cases. It was a case that distracted people from the very real problems that were going on during the Depression, almost like a dark fairy tale. And Duty's photograph appeared in newspapers across the country under the legend Dog Twice Bereft, because his first family were killed in a tornado west of Chicago, and the Eichers adopted him, and then they too vanished. in my novel. Emily Thornhill adopts him, partly because she considers him a material witness to the crime. Emily breathed in the crushed green smells of earth, wild mustard, honeysuckle, and then a darker scent. They pulled carefully onto an open dirt road before the garage, which was rude and small, square, flat-roofed, with wooden doors in front. The crowd, perhaps 200 or more, stood quietly, all looked toward the back of the building. Emily heard then the pounding of pickaxes and the slough of dirt, shoveled and thrown. The smell was the ditch, uncovered. They're gone now, she told herself. They're not here, not even their bodies. But the men were still digging, and the crowd was waiting. A quiet restlessness moved among them. Few spoke, and only in lowered voices. The ditch, a deep gash, ran straight some 40 or 50 feet from the garage to the back of the lot. Duty struggled forward on the leash, dragging Emily to the very edge of the ditch. It seemed he might jump in, and the thought horrified her. The ditch was muddy and wet, for it opened into a little creek whose dark green water lay nearly still, barely visible through towering weeds. Scrub trees and purple stocky blooms, taller than the men who stood near them. Was that Queen Anne's lace grown to such a height? The white flowers were the size of parasols. A smaller ditch, the uncovered gas line, bisected the large one. The two indentions formed a shape very like a cross that emptied into the water. Emily turned, pulling the dog with her, peering past the disturbed ground as far as the horizon. The creek looked no more than 15 feet across, and she could see the water move, a glowing lip against the opposite shore and gently ascending meadow. Heavy-limbed trees stood silhouetted in the field, their canopies subtly stirring. The sky was pale blue against the darker earth, and the creek seemed to mark a line between one world and another. She imagined walking across the water, leading Duty on the leash to that other empty meadow that lay bathed in the softest pearlized light. But none of them on this side were worthy of that place. Thank you.
Jane Ann Phillips at the Kansas City Public Library for the Writers at Work series, hosted by UNKC's New Letters Distinguished Writer in Residence, Whitney Terrell.
I'm thinking about this in a practical way, because if I was putting myself in your shoes as you're putting this story together, and there's a certain point when the people who are telling the novel at the beginning aren't going to be available to tell the novel. And then who is going to carry the story for me? And I assume that Emily became that person. Did you know that from the beginning that she was going to do that?
Not really, but when I was researching the story, it's also an Americana novel. I mean, it sort of talks about the world as it was in America at that time. So many of the characters were immigrants. So many of them came to America as young adults from different places in the world.
Right.
And, you know, there's always this story about come to America and make it big, or come to America and realize your dream. And not everyone did. Now, some people came to America and bad things happened. And I was discovering this story largely through newspapers. And I was very aware of the fact that the story was trumpeted through newspapers. It sold newspapers.
Right.
You know, newspapers used it in a sense. The idea of matrimonial agencies and a predator reaching middle-aged widows. Back then, every town had two or three newspapers, and they published twice, sometimes three times a day. I mean, it was a very different world. The printed word was the way the world moved, the way people got their news. So it was natural when I was reading so much about the trial, and there was a reporting about the Opera House and the fact that 1,200 people every day filled the Opera House, lined up around the block to get in to watch the trial. And the whole orchestra, 70 seats were reserved for press from across the country. And there was a paragraph about certain reporters arriving, and one of them was a famous woman journalist from the Chicago Tribune. I'm sure she was probably older than Emily Thornhill. But there certainly were women journalists at that time. And there's a real foil set up between Asta Eicher, who is a kind of old world European living in America, and Emily Thornhill, who has the resources to live her life the way that she wants. But the fact that she's chosen this very professional life might be one reason that she's so arrested by particularly Annabelle Eicher, whose drawings she gathers, whose house she visits. And she sees in the child's drawings some kind of extraordinary perception. And she thinks to herself, people didn't know that she was different, and I'm not going to say anything about it because it doesn't change anything that right. happened. But she becomes invested in finding justice for the family because the evidence was all circumstantial, and he might have gone free.
Okay, so this is a book that's dealing with the problem of what to do about what seems to be a completely evil act. How do you balance or deal with it? There's a discussion between Emily Thornhill, the reporter, and William Malone, who's a banker. And she asks him, what is grace, William? How is sin conquered when it is tortured and killed? And he says, grace is an element of the divine within the realm of the natural world in which time passes. And then I started to look for moments of grace. Emily doesn't fit in her society exactly because she's single. And then Eric mm-hmm. Lindstrom, who she ends up paired with, is different in certain ways, right? Mm-hmm. So there are alliances formed by people who are outside of the normal moral structure of society mm-hmm. in the same way that Powers was. But these are different kinds of
alliances.
Well, not
in alliances. The same way.
Well, no, okay, right. They're outside, but they use it gracefully.
One thing that's at work in the book is that there is this senselessness to what Powers does. And Emily and Eric discuss it kind of at length. The book is also a love story in a lot of ways. And it's the story of a group of people who didn't know one another, who are basically pulled together by the tragedy. They form yeah. very intense bonds, as people do, around a tragedy. And they intervene in finding justice for the family, because that's all that really can be found for them. But in the way that they are pulled together, they become almost a kind of non-traditional family. It's almost a kind of call and answer.
Yeah.
This family vanishes, but the group of people who intervene, not only to find justice for them, but to remember them, because their lives are so changed by having participated,
right.
by having become, in a sense, the family that this family didn't have
right.
to stand up for them.
So that call and response between grace and evil, as you phrase it, was that something that you began to notice in the book and then consciously began to work, or was it something that you had planned to do from the beginning?
Well, I didn't really plan to do it from the beginning, but the photographs also suggested some of it to me.
Okay, how's that?
Well, I can't tell you exactly. People who have read the book, I can tell you, but after you've read the book, you'll go back and look at some of the photographs a little differently.
Right, okay. Maybe you could also talk about the original stories that you heard from your mom.
Well, my mother told me when I was not much older than Annabelle Eicher, who's 9, that she remembered walking with her mother, holding her mother's hand. She was 6 years old, along a hot, dusty, crowded road, heat of August. She was so small that she couldn't see through the crowd. But as they walked past what they called the murder garage, she heard the crowd taking apart the building piece by piece for souvenirs, her exact words.
Oh.
And she also said that she could see cars parked as far as she could see. And the newspapers said that 50,000 cars visited the scene. That seems like an exaggeration. But a lot of people from states around visited the scene. And that's one of the tricky things that I deal with in the book. There's a scene between Sheriff Grimm and Emily Thornhill. He's the sheriff in Clarksburg who's responsible for the case. And she questions him at one point about the fact that so many people are coming to walk past this scene. He says something to the effect that for them it's like a rocket ship has buried itself in the ground. This is not of them. It's not from them.
Oh, yes.
It's
yes,
a kind of otherworldly thing that is almost been visited upon them. And their act of walking past it is almost an act of contrition as well as a kind of wonderment that something like this could happen. Yeah. Nothing like that had happened there before, and nothing like that has happened there since. And he also says at one point, Powers is not homegrown. He has a record and we'll find out who he is. But the search for who he really was is one of the mysteries that Quiet Dell moves through.
Quiet Dell is Jane Ann Phillips' fifth novel based on West Virginia's famous 1930s mass murder. She's talking with Whitney Terrell here on New Letters on the Air.
Almost all the names in the book are real.
All of them very freaky.
And all true.
I know, so you can only get away with that if they're real. I mean, you can only call the sheriff Grimm if that, in fact, is his name.
Exactly. The hotel where the principal stayed during the trial was the Gore Hotel.
It's unbelievable.
The clerk at the hotel was named Truman Parrish. And as I began to research the story, there are such strange coincidences that you encounter as a writer that they almost seem paranormal.
The dog duty?
The dog duty.
Okay.
And the mother says, they try to give the dog another name, but the dog is actually 4 or 5 years old and won't answer to another name. And he comes with a collar that spells out D-U-T-Y. And the mother finally says, his name will serve to instruct. There are more of those strange coincidental things that I'm not going to announce, because when we find out who Harry Powers really is, it's another amazing name.
I'm not allowed to say that
no.
name. You had to do a lot of research. The book has photographs in it and quotes that are from real newspapers that are woven in with the fiction. And research is fine, but there has to be some spark that makes the imagination start to go. And I'm wondering where that came from.
I think it was in the story that my mother told, because those exact phrases appear in the book. But I really didn't know much about the story until I began to research. In my hometown library, I found a very salacious kind of make money book about the case called Harry Powers, Bluebeard of Quiet Dell. And it was written by a lawyer who'd actually represented Powers in a suit against a vacuum cleaner company for which he worked. Powers never paid him. He wrote this book, and it had the story of the crime in it. And in fact, a couple of things that newspapers didn't mention, I think because at that time newspapers didn't mention one darker detail in particular. I got a copy of that book, and it had a few photographs in it. And then I went to the Rare Book Library in Clarksburg, Harrison County, West Virginia. And I Xeroxed lots of newspaper pages. And one of the things I Xeroxed was the scrapbook of a 13-year-old boy. He had kept this scrapbook with things sort of haphazardly pasted in together. And that 13-year-old boy grew up to be James Law, who owned the only bookstore in the area where we always used to go to buy books in Clarksburg. There were other details about Harry Powers, where he really came from, that I discovered in my research that were so astounding, I had to find a way to put them in the book, because it went to the heart of why someone does this. The sort of question that we still grapple with, which is, are they born in some way without the ability to feel empathy? Has someone hurt them so that they're arrested inside? And of course, I had no way of knowing any of these things. I had a kind of intuition about the children. And I had to find a story about Asta Eicher that made it believable that she was especially vulnerable.
She is vulnerable. And I want to talk about that. Women who responded to these ads, they're looking for the same kinds of relationships that Emily and William and these other characters managed to find with each other. It's just that Harry Powers preys on that searching.
The group of characters you're talking about, this case is so kind of dark. It's a kind of relief against which they come to know each other rather quickly and very deeply.
Right.
Whereas, of course, women writing to matrimonial agencies didn't know at all who they were writing to. And Powers' letters were very skilled manipulations. He had certain code words, code phrases that he used to advance a correspondence to a particular level and on to another level. And his letters are quoted in the book.
Maybe you could talk about that phenomenon of these people writing letters to meet each other at that time period. And why do you feel like these women were vulnerable to somebody like Powers?
Well, very specifically for Asta Eicher, I mean, that's in the book, but I think everybody has their specific story. But remember that in the 1930s, life expectancy was probably about 50, 55. And many people were widowed, particularly, I think, women. And, you know, women who had either raised their children or had never had children, who were living alone in some apartment or on some farm, if they went voluntarily, took all the money out of their bank account and set off, never to be seen again, no one really asked any questions except their own families, and they had no way to search for them. Right. I mean, in 1931, if you drove two states away, you could be a different person. There was no
right
tracking of anyone. Powers had only lived in Clarksburg for 4 years, and he'd married a woman that he met through a matrimonial agency, and the book goes into that in some detail, that she almost functioned as a kind of cover for him. But before that, he lived in Clarksburg, West Virginia. He was traveling constantly across the United States.
Right.
And no one knows what went on during those years.
So there was a line, I think this is from Emily, and she says, Powers and the case itself were excuses to shame women and keep them in their places. How does she come to that opinion?
The press was using the case to lecture women about staying inside society's protections. It was not ladylike to write to a matrimonial agency. It was not accepted to have romantic or sexual feelings beyond the age of what they called fat and 40. And certainly Asta Eicher was not fat. I don't know if you would say that she was beautiful, but she had a beauty about her. And we know that Asta Eicher has begun writing to this suitor out of her loneliness, and because she has nowhere to turn, she really is about to lose her home. Another one of society's strictures is don't have romantic hopes, but really women had no way but to marry someone who could take care of them. She was a silversmith, but because of the Depression, she was no longer able to make money as an artist. She was raising three children. There was very little she could do. I mean, she was already renting out rooms in her home. She was really motivated by trying to find someone who could help her keep her children safe. The children themselves, whose lives were so brief, I wanted them to be understood and for the reader to feel the love they had for one another. And there are dark moments and dark elements to the story, but I found it to be a very hopeful book because it's not a book about the murderer.
Growing up, did you enjoy reading fiction or nonfiction, and how has that influenced you?
I would say the most influential books were Andersen's Fairy Tales, Grimm's Fairy Tales. They were read to me, and then I read them myself. And one of the stories that was very much with me in this book was my favorite fairy tale, The Little Match Girl, because there's a lot in the book about the grandmother as this kind of magical figure and who now is gone. And you may remember, if you haven't read The Little Match Girl, you must read it. I made all my students read it this year. They don't read fairy tales anymore.
No, they do not.
Yeah, big mistake.
Fairy tales are tough.
But I was very, very aware of Annabelle's relationship with her grandmother, Lavinia, who starts out saying, the cord that binds your soul to mine, no matter what. And in fact, it turns out to be true. And that is pretty hopeful.
I think we should give Jane Ann Phillips a round of applause.
Well, thank you.
Jane Ann Phillips' fifth novel, Quiet Dell, was part of the Fall 2014 Writers at Work series at the Kansas City Public Library with UMKC's Whitney Terrell. For more, visit our website, newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine, today's show was produced with Jamie Walsh, Elizabeth Albano, Sean Weir, Anju Christopher, and Coy Duggar. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.